This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We start our show today with the next installment of Unsolved, a podcast produced by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It goes along with a series of articles recounting the case of John Zara, a teenager from Franklin who was murdered 40 years ago this week.
Here's part six.
Previously on Unsolved. Michael Yaporsky was a substitute teacher and part-time hall monitor at Franklin High School back in 1976. As a juvenile and up until his teens and very early 20s, Mike Yaporsky had been arrested a few times and had some contact with the police due to actions that he would take with boys. When he was a kid, the boys were a little bit younger than him, but then as he got into his late teens, they were about the same age. And his history includes finding these boys and accosting them, taking off their shoes and socks, and playing with their feet. Back in the 60s, when Mike Yaporsky had these interactions with the police were very focused on trying to help him because he didn't beat up the boys, didn't molest the boys. And there was no indication that any of this was done for sexual gratification. So although it was strange and it was disorderly conduct, it wasn't a serious crime. You may recall that when John's body was found, he was unclothed, but also his shoes and socks were taken off, and the socks were tucked inside of the shoes, which is something that the police thought someone with an unusual interest in kids' feet might do.
In interviews with other victims that Yaporsky had, he would take the shoes, he would take the socks, he would put the socks inside the shoes, he would lay them in a specific place.
The police were not able to find any evidence against Yaporsky.
I did not either accidentally or on purpose take the life of John Zara.
If it proves that he is not our guy, yeah, I personally would feel bad that we've basically kind of ruined this guy's life.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. At the time of 14-year-old John Zara's death in 1976, Elaine Samuels was an associate medical examiner for Milwaukee County. She's the one who performed the autopsy on John's body, and decades later, her shoddy work would continue to be a source of frustration for investigators. The first I heard of Elaine Samuels was from Detective Schoonover, and just the tone of voice that he used when he said her name told me something was up with her. Here's Meg Kissinger, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who covered some of the controversy surrounding Dr. Samuels back in the 1980s.
Dr. Samuels was an unusual woman. She looked very eccentric. She was very excitable. She was just an unusual woman. She dressed slovenly. She had cat-eye glasses. She wore her hair kind of up in a messy bun back before that was fashionable. She looked disheveled.
Ron Legro, a reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel back in those days, agrees with Meg's assessment.
I just think of Elsa Lanchester in a monster movie. I mean, she was very odd, and I'm sure she was a nice person, but she had there were these quirks about her.
In the 1980s, errors Dr. Samuels made while investigating various crimes would make it difficult, if not impossible, to bring criminals to justice. Here's Meg Kissinger again.
There were two cases involving two rape cases where the semen samples were not handled properly and the evidence in those cases had to be destroyed or couldn't be used in court. And so the prosecutors, you know, couldn't go forward, obviously, and so that was a big problem.
There was a homicide case in which Dr. Samuels boiled a dead woman's neck bone. That made it impossible to prove whether the fracture caused the death or occurred afterward. Police thought the woman's son had killed her, but without that evidence, they couldn't prove it. He would spend less than 2 years in jail. And in several other instances, she failed to complete autopsy reports. There were a lot of questions about Dr. Samuels and what kind of training she had, whether her expertise was at the level it should be in order to be doing homicide investigations. And later in 1976, the year that John died, she actually failed a test to become board certified in pathology, and yet she was allowed to keep her job. It wasn't clear to me exactly why.
In the midst of reporting on these botched cases, we had decided, let's check her background. Let's look at her qualifications. You needed five qualifications, and she had two of them. So therefore, she was not a very good witness in court. So there was a lot of pressure at the time. There was a lot of pressure on her because there was bad publicity about these botched cases, and now it was known that she didn't meet the qualifications. Her lack of qualifications was a problem for her, and it's a problem for the district attorney. It was a big problem for the district attorney because, as you might imagine, defense lawyers were quick to pounce on the fact that, A, she was eccentric, B, she lacked the proper qualifications.
Dr. Samuel's unusual personality, as well as notoriety for botching cases, would pique the interest of journalists at the time.
When I started to look in to her background, I learned that some years earlier, about 6 years earlier, she had made front page news when it was revealed that she had kept a jar of testicles in the medical examiner's office. And she later explained that that was because of some research that she was conducting. But as you might imagine, it didn't go over very well with the public, and so she was admonished.
The other thing that was interesting about that is nobody was ever able to find any evidence that she had done any research. There were no reports, no records of testing or anything like that, no indication that she had interviewed the survivors to find out anything about their habits. She claimed that she was trying to research the fertility or infertility of men based on whether they were heavy drug users or not. The reporters who were around back in the day tell me that Dr. Samuels was always great for a quote. She never shied away from being interviewed and always was willing to step up and defend herself from criticism. And so she got fairly defensive about the reports of her testicle collection and basically said, hey, we remove testicles during an autopsy anyway. What's the difference if I put them in a jar or put them back in the body?
Being a reporter in those days was right out of an old black and white film noir. It was, you never knew what somebody was going to tell you. And then I think for reporters, it was frustrating, but it was an institutionally salacious little thing that went on that we could talk about after deadline at the bar.
Dr. Samuels' odd and erratic behavior would continue after the story of her grotesque collection and botched cases made headlines.
And I got a phone call from her one morning, frantic, and she was sure, she was convinced that someone was trying to kill her. And she said she had been driving home the night before and her car burst into flames. So we looked into that, of course, and the fire deputy chief who examined the incident determined that it was not any accelerant or it wasn't caused by anything other than just a faulty, it was a faulty plug. It was a mechanical issue and not evil doing. But that didn't calm her down.
The Milwaukee County Board would ultimately eliminate Dr. Samuels' position as an associate medical examiner. But decades later, her errors would become a problem for investigators on the Zara case. Going back and reviewing the autopsy, the police realized that there were a lot of issues with Dr. Samuel's work. The first one was that she hadn't kept the stomach contents. So when the police went back, looked to try to figure out what was his last meal, what could that mean about the time of death, they couldn't double check that. Then there were no fingernail scrapings or hair samples. Anything like that that might have had evidence of, did John try to fight off his attacker and could have helped the police identify certain descriptions of this person. The discrepancies between Dr. Samuel's notes and the final autopsy report would pose a problem for investigators like Detective Kent Schoonover, who started looking into John's cold case in 2001.
Subsequent to interviewing the doctor that did the autopsy, I was looking for something in 2001 and on. I was looking for the swabs used to collect the samples. They no longer exist. She claims that the cops from Hales Corners told him to throw away. Well, I personally don't believe that happened. I wouldn't want to think that a cop would tell someone to throw away some evidence, you know. But the fact remains, it doesn't exist. It's nowhere to be found. So something happened to it. Is she putting the blame on somebody else? It could be. I don't know.
In the notes of the autopsy, Detective Schoonover found this just little phrase in Dr. Samuel's handwriting, and it said, semen in rectum. And that sounded really strange to him because he had read the entire autopsy report, and there was no mention of semen or preserving it or testing biological evidence like that. But still, when he found that note, that gave him some hope that maybe there actually was DNA for this case. For those of you who have been listening to our podcast, you'll be familiar with what happens next. Detective Schoonover calls over to the medical examiner's office and asks them for the box of evidence in John Zara's case. They weren't sure they would find it, since the safety building where the evidence was stored is rather decrepit. Eventually, they did find the box, but the slides that were supposed to have DNA on them revealed no traces of it whatsoever. And since Dr. Samuels had thrown out the swabs she used to collect the samples, investigators couldn't use those to find DNA evidence either.
We had very, very high hopes, and those were dashed very, very quickly with the there's nothing there.
But Schoonover and Detective Scott Stull of the Franklin Police Department wouldn't let the issues with Dr. Samuels' evidence collection stop their investigation. Instead, they revisited their lead suspect at the time, a man named Mike Uporsky, who had been a full-time substitute teacher at Franklin High School when John was killed. The detectives would fly to California and interrogate Uporsky using any and every method they could think of.
And one of the techniques or tactics that I decided to use, and we are allowed to do these things, you know, police are allowed to use deception in an interview, is I took that crime lab report and I rewrote it, saying that his DNA did match. So when we did this interview, we went to his house, knocked on the door, he was home. He readily agreed to come up to the Redondo Police Department for an interview. We interviewed him for probably almost 5 hours, a little over 5 hours. We tried, frankly, every interview technique that we knew of, that anybody knew of, I think. And he denied his involvement.
I didn't have a relationship with John, and I don't think probably John had a relationship with anybody. Tell you the truth.
Well, then how did we link you to him, his body, through DNA?
Yeah.
You're an intelligent man. Tell me. How did we link you?
You know, I can't answer that.
Why not?
Because...
We can explain how it is. You can explain how it isn't.
You need to answer that, Mike.
You need to
answer this.
There's no answer.
What do you mean there's no answer? The answer is you're there.
No,
you were there.
I was never with John Zara on a one-on-one basis in my entire year at Franklin High School. Never was.
But the investigation into Uporsky would stall when investigators got a new lead concerning Dan Acker, a pedophile swim coach who had a shrine to dead children in his basement. Acker also led his own investigation into John's death for decades, an obsession that would worry investigators. Today, Schoonover believes that Yaporsky is most likely innocent. And he didn't say, oh, 100%, he's positive Yaporsky didn't do it, but he's definitely coming down on the side of Yaporsky probably didn't do it. Mike Yaporsky doesn't hold a grudge against the investigators. This seemed odd to me, since he had lost two jobs and had some relationships destroyed by investigators. Here's an excerpt from an email Yaporsky wrote to me, read by a narrator from our newsroom.
I was really a mess. One thing saved me from real depression. On my drive to Arizona, I picked up a hitchhiker and he rode with me for 500 miles and I drove him directly to his family home. He was a college athlete from a poor family and was going home from school because he had been diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. Bright, articulate college football player, on a journey home to die with his family. And all that happened to me was banishment from pro basketball. It sure changed my whole outlook again. From Arizona, I flew back to attend his funeral and told his parents that he may have saved my life. I think it gave them a positive to cling to.
So where does this leave the detectives? At this point, it's 2009 and Schoonover has been focusing on one suspect, Mike Yaporsky, for years. He gets a tip about Dan Acker, but building a case against him would be difficult without DNA evidence. Schoonover would turn to Richard Walter. Walter is a pioneering profiler and crime scene analyst known for catching serial killers.
Richard's got a very unique personality. He's a brilliant guy, unique personality, but he's a chain smoker. And he can't go very long without having a cigarette.
Schoonover would talk with Walter about the investigation into John's case for 3 hours. Walter became convinced that Acker was responsible for John's murder. Here's why, in Walter's own words.
Acker, at that point, had raised his hand on so many key critical points that he was a primary person of interest that could never be dismissed. If you rely on independent accounts of where he may have been or where he was or what he was doing or whatever else, okay, as opposed to what he has to say, okay, and of course he has an interest in bragging and interjecting himself into the crime. But he also has an interest that he's not wanting to go to jail.
When Schoonover told the profiler that Acker had kept a diary about John's case for decades, Walter stopped in his tracks.
I was going out to smoke, and then he said, when you come back, I'll tell you about the diary, which caught my attention. As soon as I knew that a diary existed, that's called not only a clue, that's also called a major red flag.
Walter believes it's a red flag because, in his mind, Acker most likely killed John. But that's not all. If the warning signs were correct, he had all the makings of a serial killer. Next time on Unsolved.
But we never had that one key witness who really had evidence that could really break things one way or the other. You gotta have to hope that that person's actually out there. I can't be anything but positive that we're gonna be able to solve it. If you're not positive, nothing good's going to come of it. When I speak with Mark and I speak with Phil and I spoke with Johnny's dad, John, I can't even begin to tell them that I understand, because I don't. I'm not the victim. I can think I understand, but I can't understand, and I won't really know what it really does, what it'll mean in the end.
Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved.
Unsolved is presented in partnership with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll have the last installment of the series tomorrow and Sunday on Lake Effect Weekend.